This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. We have another fun interview for you. This young gentleman got his start back in the late 80s, early 90s, and it was a real pleasure for me to get a chance to work with him. But it was really early in his career, and I'm proud to say that he's gone on to some great fame and fortune. He's been in several TV shows, including Conan O'Brien, The Letterman Show twice. He was a regular on Flight of the Conchords. He was in a movie called Car Babes. And then, if you didn't know already, he went over to Australia, which is where he is today, and that's where we're talking to him from. So if it sounds strange, that's what it is. But he did a couple late shows there and just almost overnight became a huge star in Australia. Ladies and gentlemen, I know you know the name. He's a very funny guy. Please welcome Arj Barker. Arj, it's so great to have you back on the show. We had a chance to chat a little bit on one of the roundtables, but this will be a little more about you, and thanks for being here today.
No problem. Yeah, it's good. It was good to hear from you, and a nice surprise when I heard that Tony and Karen were doing the chat. I was like, I want to crash that. You know, I want to get involved, because those are such special days, the early days, Laughs Unlimited, your club. Really a special chapter for all of us.
Well, thanks for saying so. And it was really lucky for us that we got a chance to hook up with some terrific young talent, Tony Kameen, you're referencing, and Karen Anderson. But also in the late 80s, I believe it was about 1989 or so, you came out of the Bay Area. Was that how you remember your start? I mean, what got you into stand-up?
I had one friend who... He and I were sort of the funny guys in our crew. And I don't know why he didn't try it, but he said, I should try it. He said, Arch, you should do stand-up. We were watching a lot of comedy on the late, like Evening at the Improv was on all the time. And comedy was really popular. And so he started to occasionally say, hey, why don't you do that? You'd be awesome at that. And I sort of said, nah, I don't know. But eventually, finally, he kind of, I mean, I've always given him credit. You know, his name is Doug.
Was that Doug Benson?
No, I didn't meet him for quite a while. Although at that time, I would have seen him on Doug Benson on the Improv with his glasses that had the little birds pecking him, as I recall. so that was, and the funny thing is back then, I assumed all these guys on TV were rich. You know, that's very naive. But I thought they'd all made it because they were on Evening at the Improv.
Yeah, and it's important that you mention that, because the regular person, normal audience people, think that if they see you on TV, you're like a TV star, you're making big bucks and stuff. And actually, Evening at the Improv and my own show, Live at Laughs, and several of the other those early comedy shows from the 80s were showcase shows. And if you were lucky to get, like $50, $100 to do those things.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how much Evening at the Improv paid. I don't know. I assumed it paid, a grand or two, but even that's not life changing. And it probably back then though, it would have helped your numbers to be on those shows, because people did watch them a lot and comedy clubs were so popular. But anyway, I just tried it, finally got the nerve up and did an open mic at the Holy City Zoo.
Oh, really? That was your first one?
Absolutely. And I was completely hooked. Although I will say that without even realizing it, I'd already done stand up as a child at summer camp, because I used to go to these family camps, usually once or twice a summer with my family. They were vaguely Christian, but they weren't fundamental or they weren't evangelical or they weren't pushing it really anything on me. But they would have a skit night, like a talent show. towards the end of the week. And at one point I wrote a monologue, you know, about the camp, about a softball game and an argument that broke out between the adults. And I was mocking that in like a Howard Cosell voice.
Oh, and that's
it was basically a stand-up monologue, you know, looking back. But at the time I just thought, oh, I've written this. I just thought I'm doing comedy. I'm making a comedy skit, or I don't know what I thought, but I basically stood there at a microphone and was getting laughs. And I was only about, you know, 9, well, maybe 11. I mean, I'd have to just be guessing, but, when I look back, that was my first set, to be honest.
Oh, that's hilarious. And what an interesting way to start. What's funny is, or ironic is that you were already nurturing some skills that really helped you later on, because you're a proficient comedy writer, television, movies, your own specials and events. And I was talking to Tony Kameen about this, and he was praising you for being a much better writer than him. And if you started at an early age understanding and enjoying the writing aspect, it really helps you as a comic. Now, we've talked to several people that got their start at the Holy City Zoo. You know, Dana Carvey was a regular there, Robin Williams, many, many others. I did know you were not in that set. That's really terrific. Do you remember any of your first jokes?
Yeah, I do. They were pretty simple, but I do remember my first set. Probably remember a couple jokes. One of them was, you know, they're looking back, they're kind of innocent, you know, jokes. Cause, well, obviously it's my first jokes, but it was stuff like, one of them was like, well, forgive me, I'm a little nervous. You know, all I did was reverse the letters, which isn't even now doesn't even almost seem like a joke, but it, you know, I think I was so nervous that it got, maybe it got a nervous laugh. It was only about, you know, 15 people in the audience.
Yeah, the Zoom was not very big, yeah.
So it's a small club, so it'd probably pack out at 50 or 60. Let's see what else. I think I had a gag about, I'm really into safety. You know, I have handlebars on my toilet. I wear a helmet in the shower. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, what's interesting is the more you go, the more you impose rules about what makes a joke and what makes a joke worthy of you. But when you start as a stand-up, at least for me, I had no rules as to what the joke needed to be. Well, I didn't understand the concept of hacky or original. I understood that I would never, you know, steal a joke. Even then, I knew that. Like, I knew it had to be my own thing, but I didn't think like, oh, that's too easy, or that's too hacky, or that's, you know. And also, yeah, so it was more free time as far as trying stuff on stage. Like props. Oh, sure, I'll take this weird whistly tube up on stage with me because it's funny. But now I would never do that. I'd be like, I'm not bringing a whistly tube with me. I think you become more refined and strict about what you want to do for your own act. But back then it was like anything goes. And looking back at my jokes, I can see that.
Yeah, but I
could probably think of a couple more, but they're not much better than that. So.
Well, the point is that, and I think you're stating it very clearly, is that everybody that gets into any new art form or even any new business in the beginning, you're an amateur. You're, like you said, trying anything and everything to see what sticks before you kind of find your own voice. You know, obviously, as you kept working past that initial set at the Holy City Zoo, you found some material that worked, because if you didn't, you wouldn't work for me at Laughs Unlimited. Now, how did you end up coming up to Sacramento?
Oh, that's a good question. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think my first exposure to your clubs was the comedy contest that you used to have. So I would have signed up for that. And I believe that was 92. So I've been doing comedy already a little over 2 years, and I was hungry for any stage time. So I would have been going every chance I got, I would have been going on stage.
Yeah, and what Arj is referencing is we used to do the Northern California Comedy Competition, and it was a way, really, for me as a producer and booker to discover and find new talents, and there was a lot of people that came out of that. Brian Posehn and others, you know, Tony, there was a number of people that I think, you know, was introduced to me through that competition, but I'm glad that I did it because... Cool. You were a regular at the club in the early 90s.
Well, let alone, yeah, I mean, those guys are terrific. But even, I mean, one of the great legends of comedy was in the contest with me and placed second. I came in third. Mike Uriga won it. And Mitch Hedberg was second place.
Oh, and, Mitch?
Yeah, and Mitch and I both were awarded a week of opening at your club as part of the, you know, our prize for coming in the top three. I think Uriga got the feature, as I recall. And we actually got our weeks simultaneously. So I think I was Citrus Heights and he was in the downtown club. And so that's when Mitch and I first hung out. I mean, we met at the contest. And we're friendly, and then we were catching up during the daytime while we were doing what for me was my first really week on the road. I think he had been working already a little bit coming out of the northeast, making his way from Minnesota. I think he'd done some other gigs across the country, but that was really my first week at a club.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
So it was very, very memorable for me.
Oh, that's cool. And your memory, course, on this is better than mine. I did about a dozen of those comedy competitions. I don't remember who won and did what. And then you are not the only person that Laughs Unlimited was their first road gig. It was even Will Durst and a few others. It was early for them. That was a decade before you, but I mean, it was their first road gig and giving them an opportunity. And I didn't remember that Mitch Hedberg came in second. That had to have been a heck of a competition.
Well, it was, it was good. Well, he, you know, in his early years, I think some people didn't really get him. You know, he was pretty different. And, I think in the end, that's the only reason he didn't win was just because he was very unique. And whereas Mike Uriga, who's a great comic, and not to put him down at all, and he's a good friend of mine, you know, he really kills, you know. So,
well, being unique and different. I mean, look at Emo Phillips or Bobcat Goldthwait. You know, it took the audience a little aside at first because it wasn't straight monology. They were coming with a character, you know, and that they had to adapt to that character. And Mitch Hedberg was the same, but I think it makes me feel good that you guys became friends and you kind of developed together. Now in those early days, it is important to get stage time. As you mentioned, what kind of places were you finding work and any fun stories from those early road days?
Well, the most important source of stage time for me in the first, let's say, 3 years of stand-up, which really was invaluable, was that I'm from a town called San Anselmo, which is in Marin County, across from the San Francisco, across the Golden Gate Bridge. That's Marin County. I'm from a small town there called San Anselmo. And there happened to be an open mic that ran every Sunday at a venue called Cafe Nuevo, which was just a little like coffee shop, really quite pretty small. And it had a back deck that was over a creek. And I rocked up there after having done comedy probably for a few months or whatever. I'm not good with exact timelines, so you'll have to forgive me. And maybe I've been doing it, you know, a year. I don't know. I was searching anywhere to get stage time. I'd literally go up anywhere that they'd let me. And I did a set, and I would have invited friends down, so I had a supportive audience. And my friends were back in those days, were excited to come see me do a show. They're not anymore, but.
And nature of the beast.
They're all over it. Anyway, I don't know if it happened right away, but I basically started hosting that show every other week. So every two Sundays would be my night. And I really grew an audience there. It became kind of like, Art is doing Nuvo tonight type of thing. It was really remarkable because I don't know how long it took, and it's not huge. So, you know, put things in perspective, it might have been packed out with, you know, 70 people or whatever.
Yeah, but.
But it would be packed.
Yeah, but to interrupt.
It got to the point where it would be.
I was just going to say and interrupt and say that I've explained to a lot of young comics, and it's part of my comedy course, is that you want to get on stage. And if you could become a house MC or host a show, that is so important to the development, because not only you have material that you can share and work on, but you're also building that interaction with the audience, that comfort level. In fact, it was pointed out by a comic recently that aside from all the comics, famous and not so famous, that worked for me in the stage time they had, as the MC working 8 shows a week, 6 nights a week over 21 years, I had more stage time than any of them. And yeah. I'm not a stand-up comic, but I developed a good sense of how to deal with an audience.
Yeah, sure. And also one thing too that you might add to that is in a lot of cases you're getting some of the same audience. So you feel pressure to have something new to say. So I definitely did. So I didn't feel like it was a job. It was a joy, but I would go home from that thing so buzzed from the excitement of performing, you know, to this audience that came to see me. So I would sit in my room and fill up another page with ideas and premises. And I felt like comedy was just pouring from me back then. And it wasn't, again, it's that thing where it wasn't, you know, a lot of it I'm sure I wouldn't do now. I would do props. I would grab my guitar sometimes and make a song or impressions, whatever. There was no concept of hacky back then for me. It was just like, whatever. And I did a hell of a long time. In fact, people would come, you know, like, you know, Blaine Kapach or Greg Barron would be there, and I'd invite them down, and then the poor guys would wait. I would be doing like 25 minutes in between bringing up acts.
And that's the plus of being the host. I used to do that all the time.
Yeah, well, I would have been getting, you know, at least an hour of stage time once that thing really was in high gear. I was, you know, getting a shitload of stage time from that. And so that was really important. And so by the time I went up to do your contest, I would have already been doing quite long sets. And so hopefully I'm assuming I took what I thought was my best stuff, and that helped get me, you know, my foot in the door with you guys.
Well, you're sharing so many important things, you know, being an MC, writing new material on a regular basis to develop and build a set so that when that gig or competition comes up, you're ready to go. Now, at what point, so you started in the late 80s, early 90s, you're starting to work clubs like mine. At what point did you feel that you had, let's say, that 30-minute set that you could take anywhere on the road? Was it a aha moment, or did it just all of a sudden you turn around and you were there?
Yeah. I don't think it was definitely not a specific moment. I think to be honest, by the time I was hosting shows like in San Francisco, you know, which like the Punchlines and Cobb, I was already taking some sort of feature gigs like on the road and even probably occasionally headlining. I think even from Nuvo really gave me a taste of like headlining in a way, because people really came to see me. And I'm not saying that out of like, you know.
No, it's okay to say, you know, you were good.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be immodest, but I did feel pressure, like I need to deliver, and, you know, but I also loved it. You know, I was like, you almost had to like drag me off stage back then. I couldn't get enough.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Go ahead.
I wouldn't say there was an aha moment, but I would say that, like, by the time I got promoted to feature, that was not an issue at all, like, to do the 30 minutes. In fact, it seemed easier because we didn't have to warm the crowd up. And I definitely had the material. So I think I usually had more material than I needed at the rate that I was getting promoted. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, no. And you always want to work ahead of yourself. You know, you don't want to take a feature bit until you have, you know, 45 minutes to an hour material, knowing you can do your job for 30. And a headliner that's going to do 45 minutes to an hour should really have an hour and a half of material so that they could break it down to what's going to work on a particular audience. But you came from the Bay Area comedy scene, which was just doing well in those days. Did you get a chance to work with anybody famous or somebody you looked up to that helped guide you? I mean, mentor might be too strong a word, but were there people you learned from?
I mean, absolutely. And I will say ahead of time, I'm not very good at, like, rattling off names. So I'm not, this list wouldn't be exhaustive, but I got to work with, you know, a majority of the headliners at that time, because I hosted and featured for several years at those clubs, even before I headlined. Although I didn't get to feature very long, because I think featuring was like an underhand pitch, you know, and like I was able to smash it pretty hard. And so then I was bumped up to headliner almost quicker.
Nobody wants to follow a really good feature. So if the guy's got the nuts, you can put him up as a headliner.
Yeah, I think, you know, probably somebody canceled and I got a little break. Hey, do you want to close the show or whatever? And, you know, Tom and Will, those were the syndicate running the Bay Area back then. Tom Sawyer and...
What I was going for was you worked with a lot of people that ended up being famous. I have no doubt, especially as a host and MC, because that's how I experienced so many people. What I was going for was being an impressionable young comic that was enjoying the art form and had some goals. Was there anybody that you saw that really, like, added to your inspiration or kind of, excited you to see their style, or that maybe you picked up something from? So name dropping wasn't my point. I was just wondering if there was anybody that you got a chance to work with that made a difference in your future.
I'm not, I was also alluding to that. I was just saying that these guys that I saw, many great headliners, and I was really interested in what they were doing. Like, one of my most absolutely mind blowing moments was watching, Michael Meehan at New George's when I hadn't seen him before, and just watching him riff was like earth shattering. Like, I couldn't believe how funny he was, and still one of my all time faves. But, you know, Brian Regan's mind blowing, Jake Johansson. And these guys are also notably great guys who were so kind, you know, to take time to talk to you. And it didn't make you feel like, you know, like you were this little lonely guy that you shouldn't even talk to them. They're always, you know, had time to have a chat, and that was really helpful.
Yeah.
But yeah, just like, I was like a sponge, just watching, you know, a lot of people. And very different from nowadays. I don't watch a ton of comedy. Oh my God. I was blanking. I was thinking Will, and thinking for a last name, I was thinking of Jeff Wills, by the way, when I was naming the two guys that ran the comedy in the Bay Area.
Right.
You know,
right.
They were the guys to get in with. It was bugging me in the back of my mind. So I'm glad I remember that. Sorry, Jeff, dude. I just blank sometimes.
Well, I'll jump.
Oh yeah. My point is, I was a student of comedy, and I was really interested and probably watched most headliners at that time that I worked with. But you know, those are definitely some of my faves that I mentioned, but there were lots of great comics.
Yeah.
And things do things different, you know, like Jake Johansson, like his material is so creative and his delivery is understated and like, and incredible. Like, you know, Brian Regan just takes a premise and just milks it so hard. And just kills so hard. Like he almost makes you want to quit when you watch him. But Michael Meehan was such a goofball.
I'm going to touch on that because you mentioned Michael Meehan and how he was so good at working a crowd. What I was getting to was that as an MC and host, which you'd already kind of cut your teeth on and helped you build who you were and helped you find your voice as a comic, seeing somebody that was really had the craft down, that, you know, like you were good as an MC, but when you see somebody working an audience like Michael, I could understand why that would be have an impact on you, because it shows you there's another level. It's like if you never saw better people, you wouldn't have anything to go for as a goal. I mean, maybe a good analogy is a baseball player that gets his first home run and then he sees somebody that has 10 home runs and you go, yeah, I could, you know, I can do better. I can keep building. And watching somebody work a crowd without any sense of particular material, just working the crowd. I mean, I always appreciate when somebody can do that.
Yeah, and the intensity, you know, Michael Meehan's incredible, just energy that he emits.
Well,
I don't know. I'll never forget that. It was New George's, and he did some riff about, I think it was like playing a goat, like a musical instrument or something. It was really out there and it was just world-class. It was world-class improv and so unique. And I've never really been my thing personally, like going massively improvising, although I reserve the right to go off script and riff when I need to or when I want to, but I still just, and I love his jokes too. I mean, I could still recite a bunch of his jokes from 25 years ago that I love. But you know, he's always been one of my heroes in comedy, to be honest.
Oh, that's great, and I'm sure he appreciates that. Well, let's take the audience to the next level, because you've gotten your footing in comedy. You've had some success on the road at clubs. But what I want to share with the audience is that you took it to the next level. You were doing some TV. You got some shots on Conan O'Brien and Letterman. And I'm not sure how you ended up in New York doing the marijuana logs. Tony kind of gave part of the story. But how did you transition from a road comic to doing things like television and the marijuana logs? By the way, what do you remember what year that was?
What year? What was
the you guys first came out with the marijuana logs?
Oh, sure. Well, I would guess it was around 2001.
Okay. So you've been doing comedy for a decade, and you'd had some television exposure, but the marijuana logs was really a real shift, because now it's almost like a play. I know that Tony Kameen and Doug Benson and you put this together and had huge success with it. Did you have fun?
Absolutely. I mean, that was a hell of a chapter. Basically, as far as I recall, I thought of I said to Tony one day, I mean, literally as just a joke, I said to him, hey, we should do, you know, because the vagina monologues, by the way, in case anyone doesn't know, was massive at that time. And it was like a phenomenon, like literally like worldwide popular show. But, you know, let's talk about the B word, and vagina monologues was so famous, right?
Right. So it was three women talking about being a woman, and it was very popular at the time.
I mean, that's an understatement. I mean, as far as I recall, it was like huge, like world famous, you know, it was being farmed out to different casts all over the world. At least in my circle, it was maybe it wasn't as famous as I recall, but people knew about it. And I was just hanging out one day with this girl called Cassandra, who is a nice girl that I knew. And I just ripped it. Like, what about the marijuana logs? You know, I'll write a show. And we both laughed, but it was nothing more than that. And then I told that to Tony Kameen, and he said, that's actually ours. That's not a, That wouldn't be a bad idea to make that show, because we already had pot jokes. And then Doug, he finished the process by saying, yeah, let's do it. And Doug's a very, Doug Benson, among other things, you know, he's a hilarious guy. And when he wants to put his mind to something, like, get out of his way. Like, he's a no bullshit guy. And he wanted to be a part of it. And he really spearheaded us getting together and working on it. And we put it, you know, he was instrumental in getting it together. But we all worked together. But if you see, we all played a part in that process. Once we had it, we were all working at clubs, so we were able to book ourselves, get bookings, you know, and eventually some producers got interested and said, let's put it on off Broadway. And we went to New York, and it lasted almost, I think it lasted around a year or maybe a little bit over a year on 7th Avenue and a small theater there. And I was only there for 6 months, and then I just needed a break. You know, I was kind of doing the same show like 7-8 times a week, week after week. And plus all the partying in New York, I certainly need to get out of there.
Well, you guys had huge success with it. Not only was it a big off-Broadway hit, but you took it to a few festivals. You got it around the country a little bit. I mean,
what countries? Yeah, we did Australia, and then also actually, funnily enough, got performed in some South American countries by a cast speaking Spanish, which is kind of cool.
Oh, that's neat.
Had a couple international performances. Some of those boys did it in Amsterdam once. I didn't go to that one, but we did it in Australia. So yeah, I went around. It was never, I'd say, like a massive hit, but it was successful enough that we got to travel a lot with it, and we definitely had some good times. And the joke is like, what I can remember, it was fun.
Well, you know what's interesting, though? You said it wasn't hugely successful, but in the sense of this podcast and your career, keep in mind that going from an open mic at the Holy City Zoo to work in a few stage clubs and in getting some success as a road comic, it is a big step to going, and you even said that after 6 months, it's hard to do the same show 6 nights a week on a Broadway stage. And to be able to have that success, I think, is huge. So as a producer, I'm impressed that you were able to take, you know, your art form, stand-up comedy, convert it into a play and have that kind of success that it went international. I mean, whether you became millionaires or not, it's huge.
Well, what's sort of funny, a little side note about that, is that, you know, stand-up, you know your act generally, right? You do your show, whether you're doing 30 or 45, you have your segues, and you commit it to memory, or you're very good at riffing, one or the other. And when we did them, because it was based on the vagina monologues, where the actresses would sit on stools with a script in front of them, we allowed ourselves scripts as well. So we went from memorizing our acts to having our jokes written in front of us. And only, you know, and so in many ways it was, I would say it was easy, because, you know, you knew what was coming up, and it was in the framework of the premise. We were literally allowed to have a script there on stage. But anyway, we all knew it by heart and could have done it in our sleep. But it was still kind of funny that, you know, being that the show was about marijuana, that we had scripts in front of us.
Well, I just think it's interesting as a producer and as a guy that knew you from back in the early 90s as an opening act and feature act and stuff, that it makes me feel good that Tony Kameen and you had such great success taking this art form and your writing abilities and being able to blossom. I know that's a weird term, but blossom into the entertainers you were becoming. Now you've done TV, you've got the Marijuana Logs, which is a big success as a stage show. I know that in 2006, you were in the movie Car Babes, but you did lots of television. You've had a really diverse and successful career. Were any of those things that stood out as major stepping stones, or things that you looking back, you kind of miss?
I miss, what I really miss is the excitement of just waiting in the back of the room to go up and do your 5 minutes, but you can't ever go back there. What I would tell, and I have told comics that sometimes email me and they're excited, they're starting out. And one of the advice that I give them is, pieces of advice that I give them, cherish your formative years, because you might end up playing to bigger audiences. You may end up with lots of money. You might have your own TV show, but it'll never necessarily be more fun than it is right now. It's like the initial years of the treasure hunt of trying to come up with new bits and camaraderie that you'll have with the other comics trying to break, get their acts together. It's really, I look back on that as some of my favorite parts of my life. So, it's all been fun and interesting, and, it hasn't all been fun. It's been some tough times, but like for anyone, that's just life. But it's been a good ride, but yeah, I don't think being in a bigger production or making more money necessarily equates to that being any more exciting or fun than just like opening up for a band, your friend's band, and in San Francisco after doing comedy 5 months, and the adrenaline rush, there's nothing like it. So I don't know, the whole thing's an adventure, but don't discount the first few years just because you might be living on a friend's couch or whatever. that's part of it.
I used to say. I was just going to say that's amazing advice. So true, so strong, and it's impressive that with all the things you've done, that you can say that there's first few years of open mics and like you said, sleeping on a couch and that labeled starving artist situation is still a strong positive memory.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I never was starving. But I had day jobs, whatever I had to do. I was living, rent a room here and there, driving a Ford Escort, I was fortunate though. I can't speak on everyone's financial situation, and there's nothing really romantic about starving for sure. But I definitely wasn't making really any substantial money until after doing it for, at least almost a decade before I really started to get some good checks. But,
well, let's jump anyway, ahead.
It's just fun. It's like a treasure hunt, not in terms of monetary treasure, but in terms of just finding your path and finding the next gig and the next joke and all that. And that's what I love.
Yeah. And I think that you've spoken and shared some important things, but we need to, I didn't want to take up too much of your time, and you're down in Australia, so it's early in the morning for you and it's late in the day for me, but we have to share quickly that story. So from our roundtable talk, and because I know you, I know that you did a couple talk shows down in Australia while on tour and kind of just took off. Why don't you share with the audience real quick how you became, you're really a celebrity in Australia and continue to thrive on that. I checked your calendar. I mean, you're booked solid through 2022, and that's so exciting to hear. How did this come about?
Well, I'm going to give you the quick version just because I don't want to, I want to keep your audience engaged. Basically, I've been working a bunch around the Bay Area, and I saw Harmon Leon. I don't know if you remember that guy. He's a comic, a friend of mine. And I said, where you been? He said, I was in the UK doing stand-up. And that was such a revelation, Scott, that I didn't realize they had stand up in other countries, which is probably naive, but I didn't even think about that. And I made him give me his contacts like right then and there, or the next day. Maybe he didn't have his address book with him, but literally the next day, I'm not even kidding, I sent 3 videotapes, a VHS, cause that's what, back then that's what you did.
Right.
To the UK, to 3 different agents that he gave me contact for, and only one of them responded, but that was enough. So I booked my first tour in the UK got a rocky start there, but then hammered out a pretty effective 20-minute set. That was what you did back then, is you did all 20-minute spots and at the club, and did a ton of work there for a few years. Went to Edinburgh Festival, had pretty good success my first time there, that's a one-hour show. And the next year, an Australian producer came out and saw my show and invited me to Australia. So it was really, I really went to Europe first, and then that led to an invite to Australia.
That's kind of that show business luck.
I went to Australia. Pardon me?
Well, that's kind of like the luck of show business. I mean, you took the incentive to get to England in Edinburgh, but the fact that an Australian producer saw you there, that's like being discovered. That's a lucky fluke, and yet you earned it because you had all those years under your belt developing. I think that's good.
What do they say? I forget the exact quote, but they say it's when luck meets hard work.
Right.
Something.
Right.
I forget. Someone out there knows the quote, but I can't remember it. But you know, so I just wanted to be a comic, and I never thought twice about going to Australia. But as soon as I heard about it, I was like, definitely. Yeah. You know, I want. You know, how to find out if she liked it. You know, I was so keen to go. She's still my producer to this day. Out here, Mary Tobin, and I went out and did the Sydney Comedy Festival. It might not have been. I think it was called that. There's a different one now, not to be mixed up with that. That was around 2001 or so, 2000 maybe. And right away, I did their equivalent of the Tonight Show once, and then again the next trip. And back then, there was only a handful of TV stations here, so that started to put some butts in seats pretty early on. And once I got a taste of that, it was super fun to come out here, but also I felt like there was an opportunity. So I kept hammering it pretty hard. What always motivated me the whole time though was just the fun of working and touring and adventure. It was always secondary. Wow, this is going really good. I'm starting to make better money. That was always secondary. But one day I said, where am I performing? She said, in this theater. I said, what are you talking about? That's like 500 seats. Are you crazy? And there was a moment when I was like, wow, this is actually turning into something.
Yeah. 500 seats. Exciting. That's a big show.
Yeah. And then that just made me even more really want to be here more and push harder. And I was all through my 30s. I was hitting it as hard as I could here in Australia, and you know, doing as many, coming out as often as possible, and doing tons of shows. And I built up my profile then, and you know, that just continued. And I sort of just kept working and working, and here I am now, sitting in Melbourne.
What year did you decide to make Australia your home?
Well, that was never an exact thing. I was going and spending 3 months here, 3 months there, 6 months there, 3 months here, 4 months here, 3 months here, and back and forth. And at one point I did buy a house initially in New South Wales out in the countryside. And I would just, you know, spend a few months here and there at that house, but it was never like 100%. I think I just gravitated towards spending more time here, and eventually I had a girlfriend who turned into my wife.
Oh,
and now that's ended.
Wait a minute, Arch, did she poof and all of a sudden she turned into your wife?
Well, that's how it feels, yeah. That's how they get you.
Yeah, but, well, go ahead. I mean, I just think it's incredible. It's a little bit of an unusual story, Arch, because you're a Bay Area comic who you know, got a lot of success in Northern California. Then all of a sudden you had success across the country. Then you had success in Edinburgh and in England a bit, and then you really super success, and I'm just so proud of you, and I don't mean that in a condescending way. I'm old enough to be your father, so I'm very proud of the hard work you've put in and what it's gotten you to, and your success in Australia is well earned, and I just think it's got to be, you have to know that you're a success and that you earned it, and be proud of it, because it's an incredible feat. Good job.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. I mean, it's been interesting and fun, and I am thankful. So I'm grateful that, but I did work hard. That's true. So, but again, there definitely is some luck involved, and I would never deny that, but I think that's okay. In a long enough timeline, you know, most people will have some luck, I suppose, perhaps not all. I haven't really figured out life completely, but yeah, I'm very grateful. Thank you, Scott.
Well, the hard work, I think, is the key component that people should, that want to get into entertainment or stage life, have to understand that you are where you are and having the success you're enjoying because of all those early years of doing road shows and in writing. I mean, you're still a proficient comedy writer. You're performing so much that you always, as you mentioned a couple times, want to present new material, so that you've really become the professional that you dreamed about when you were doing those open mics at the Holy City Zoo. And I just think it's an incredible story. Now, I saw your calendar and your book pretty solid for 2022. Later this year, do you have any special gigs you want to plug, or what's your next adventure?
Well, you know, not really. I mean, just like you said, I mean, I've got gigs mostly booked in Australia at the moment because of COVID. I haven't unfortunately been able to tour in the States now. Since, 2019 is the last time. Prior to the pandemic, I would always spend a couple months touring in the States as well, and I would play various clubs, or whoever would have me, really. I played some great clubs like Cobbs or the Punchline, Acme, amazing club. There was a club in Seattle, but unfortunately, I think it shut. Parlor. Well, I love the Northwest. It's one of my favorite parts of the country to work in. So if anyone's listening from up there,
talk. Yeah, you're available to come home and work. That's great. Well, I really appreciate
it. But I don't have nothing too specific. You know, I've written a film script with a friend, and we've been trying to get that made now for a couple of years. And apparently we're close. We have a producer who's trying to sort all the funding. Supposedly, we might be shooting that this summer. American summer. I get so mixed up. But, like, we're meant to now shoot it in a sort of a low-budget incarnation in June, the comedy. But it's too early to really, you know, announce more than that.
No, but that's
developing a TV.
Still fun, something to look forward to. You know, I alluded to that I'm old enough to be your father. I'll share with the audience that at the taping of this recording, you're 48. You've already had more than a decade or two of great stage experience. You've tried several different types of entertainment, from stand-up comedy to play to movies to television. I think that you're still, obviously, to me, you're a very young man and you have a huge future ahead of you. And it doesn't surprise me at all that you might end up writing and performing and producing movies. I think that's a natural step, and I wish you a lot of luck.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. I mean, we'll see how it goes. I mean, I'm sort of at this point, like, pretty, like, okay with, you know, I'm happy to throw some lines out there, but I'm getting more, like, you know, a little more relaxed about, and probably a little less ambitious in my career, because maybe that's not a good thing. Maybe it is, but it really, I'm more about like what makes me happy than like, and that's not necessarily more work, if that makes sense. So,
hey, that just means
I just want to enjoy life and feel healthy and happy now. And I'm, you know, and in some ways I want to enjoy the fruits of my labor too. I have some, you know, I have a comfortable house and some guitars that I like to fumble with. And I enjoy woodworking. So I'm really into my hobbies, to be honest. And I don't want to work too hard. So I'm almost like, well, if the movie happens, that's great. If it doesn't, hey, you know what? I'll keep building that bedside table.
Right. Well, I just think as I reach into my retirement years that what you're explaining is the fruits of your success. It allows you that opportunity to do what you want to do and enjoy doing versus what you have to do to put food on the table. And there's nothing to be embarrassed about that. That is a goal that everybody has. And I'm just so happy that you've reached it. And I really appreciate that you've had a chance to do this interview with me. Ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned. I have a little stand-up comedy from Arch Barker and all the way from Australia. Thanks so much for doing this podcast. And again, it's just been I'm proud that I had a small part of your great career and continued success, sir.
Oh, well, thanks a lot, Scott. And yeah, thank you too for the support early on, because that did make a difference. And it's an important chapter for me. So thanks so much. It's nice to talk to you.
Yeah. Oh, well, you're welcome, and in my honor. Ladies and gentlemen, keep an eye out. Arj will be back on stage in the Northwest and other parts of the world. And
hopefully,
if you get a chance, be sure to see him live. In fact, let's give you a taste of that. Ladies and gentlemen, Arj Barker live on stage.
The other day, and all it said was, "I'm not gay, but my boyfriend is." I see a lot of people laugh at that. I'm not homophobic, but I didn't think that was funny at all. And I asked my girlfriend to take it off. No humor there. I don't have a serious girlfriend, and you know, I'd love to have one, but I don't meet the right people. I mean, one girl said she wouldn't go out with me unless I owned a car phone, which I thought was pretty bad. So I tricked her. Every time we went out, I would just bring the cordless phone from my house, put it on the handbrake with some tape. Then I go pick her up, and she fell for it. She went out with me for like a month and a half. But finally, she broke it off. She said, "Arj, it's over. It's stupid going out with you. It's just boring. We never go more than 30 feet from your house." But I don't care. I look back on it and I realize any girl that likes me for my phone or my car or anything like that is shallow. Am I right, Montreal? Yeah. And I deserve somebody that likes me for who I am pretending to be. I'm not worried anyway. Why should I be worried about settling down? I'm 28 years old and I'm in show business. So, you know, if things go well, my wife hasn't even been born yet. That's what it's all about. However, I don't mind being single anyway. You can do whatever you want. I mean, I'm not bragging, but a couple nights ago, I almost had a three-way, a menage a trois. I didn't, but I was very, very close. All I needed was two girls. I would have been so in there. I mean, I had everything else. I had a bed and a candle and a video camera. I just needed more people. Not worried about that. I don't know, I had my own place, but it got too expensive, so I moved, and it's actually a lot of fun now because I'm sharing a place with some old buddies, my parents. But I'm going to be in the money pretty soon because I'm going to win a radio contest. I've studied radio contests for years, and I've heard hundreds of them all over North America. It doesn't matter where you are, though, because everyone sounds the same. Every person reacts exactly the same way when they win a radio contest. "You're lucky caller number 7. You just won $1,000. What's your favorite radio station?" "This one." People have no shame or dignity when they win. There's no rule that says you have to love the station you won on. If I won a contest, I'd be totally honest. "You just won $1,000. What's your favorite radio station?" "Well, I jump around a lot. I like the Spanish one. This one's pretty good. What station is this anyway?" "I just had it set on Seek." "You know what I heard on the radio? They're talking about Bill Gates, and you all know he's rich, but apparently he made $3 billion in one day. Bill Gates made $3 billion in one day. I mean, that's ridiculous. $3 billion? That's more than I make in a year. I got a computer, but not to do work on it. I just love video games. And this computer came with the best video game I've ever seen built into it. It's so sweet. It's like a space game. And it's like you're flying through space and meteors are like, they fly by your head. And it feels like your room is the cockpit. And you're the captain in charge of the whole vessel. It's so badass. I don't even know how to play it yet. It's called Screensaver. And so realistic. The meteors fly by, look out, here they come! And then you hit any key and you go in the ship computer and there's a database in there, and I don't know what you do with it, but I think you gotta get the data to save the screen. But you know, I'm still on level one. What am I gonna do? I have a lot of energy. I quit smoking and I feel healthy and tons of energy, but I didn't quit for health. I quit because I'm just tired of bad news about cigarettes. That's all you ever hear. Even if they discover good news, they don't publicize it. Like the fact that smoking seriously reduces the risk of jogging. That's not in the paper. But bad news always is, I'm sure you heard the latest bad news. They just found out the camel on the pack of cigarettes isn't even a camel. No? It's actually a horse with a big old tumor growing out of its back. I know it's sad, but at least that explains why it's always in the desert by itself. I tell you, we can't afford chemotherapy. Put that beast out in the desert and take me back to India. This is Egypt, I tell you. I don't belong here. You are using the wrong accent for this joke.
Well, that was Arj Barker live on stage. Man, it was such an honor to have him call me all the way from Australia just to chat about how we got a chance to work together in the early 90s and explain how his amazing career has developed. He is a huge success in comedy, and he's a bit shy about it, but he's a bit of a celebrity in Australia, and that's why he chose to live there. Hopefully, he'll be coming home to visit here soon, and we'll get a chance to see him again live. Thanks for joining us for this tremendous interview and piece of stand-up comedy by Arj Barker, and we'll see you back next week. Thanks for listening. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand-Up Comedy, Your Host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, and our sponsors, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.